We'll call the meeting of the House Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Division to order. Members, we are going to do introductions, but we're going to wait until everyone arrives, and maybe that'll be a couple hours. I don't know. But so to accommodate that time-wise, we're going to begin today with Ms. Schill and Mr. Michael. I think Ms. Schill is going to lead us off as we get started on the overview, and then we'll do introductions as we have a fuller house. Ms. Schill, thank you for coming and preparing for us, and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Catherine Schill. I'm a fiscal analyst for the House, and today we are going to have an overview of property taxes. For your reference, you have two documents in your packet. The first is this PowerPoint presentation. It's about 49 slides, and I think we kind of doubled up on the presentation so you can take notes, so it's not a full 49 pages. But the second one is a collection of reference documents, short subjects, and that is, I think, 34, 35 pages long. That also is in your packet. To begin, in Minnesota, the governance of property taxes is a shared responsibility between state and local governments. While property taxes are the mainstay of local government finances, Minnesota's property tax system is highly centralized at the state level. State law controls a number of system features, which will be discussed in this committee this year. There will be a number of us coming forward from House Research and Fiscal Analysis, and we will discuss a number of different areas that this committee has jurisdiction over. So I will let each person introduce themselves as they come forward in this presentation. Let's start on move to slide 2, which is a discussion of state and local taxes. Combining all state and local taxes in Minnesota, fiscal 2017 tax revenues are expected to reach $32.9 billion. As shown in this pie chart on slide 2, individual taxes bring in the most revenue with $11.1 billion, or about 33% of the total. Next are property taxes at $9.3 billion, or about 28%. Statewide sales taxes are the third with about $7 billion, or 21%, and other taxes, including corporate franchise tax, the gas tax, excise taxes, at $5.8 billion, or about 18%. Of this $32.9 billion in tax collections, the split between state taxes and local tax revenues is about $23.9 billion to $9 billion, or about 2.6 to 1. On slide 3, this is a presentation of a 10-year comparison of the big three taxes, income, sales, and property taxes. The bar graph on slide 3 gives a 10-year comparison of these taxes for fiscal years 2007, 2012, and 2017. The clear bar is the sales tax. Note how the sales tax was stagnant and then slightly grows over the decade. Moving to the income tax, the light gray bar, look how it also remained flat from 2017 to 2012 and then shows notable growth in 2017. The last bar, the dark gray bar, the property tax, shows steady gains from fiscal 7 to 12 to 17. One last note, of this $32.9 billion in state and local tax collections for 2017, these three big taxes, sales, income, and property, accounted for 82.4% of the total. In fiscal 2001, more than 15 years ago, these taxes accounted for approximately 85% of state and local tax collections. Oops. The next slide is just a quick overview of the fiscal.
Michelle, we have one question. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question that I have is, with the sales tax growth, was that because rates went up, or did people suddenly start shopping more? Do you know what drove that?
Ms. Schill?
I will defer to Ms. Dalton.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, actually sales taxes, which are the white bar, have been relatively constant. The growth has primarily been just due to regular inflation in prices.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton, I apologize. I looked at the wrong bar. I was referring to the middle bar, which is individual income. Is that just, you know, income going up, or did taxes go up?
Ms. Dalton.
Okay, sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, I will actually defer to Joel, who is one of our income tax people, but it is because there was a rate increase, and I'll let him.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, the growth in income is attributable to really two, in income revenues is attributable really to two things. One is overall income has grown, and so the tax base has grown. But also, very importantly, in 2013, there was the fourth tier, the tax bill enacted, the increase in the income tax rates that applied to higher income filers. And at the time, that was estimated to raise, you know, close to $1 billion. So that's a fair chunk of that growth in that bar is attributable to legislated rate changes in addition to income growth.
Thank you, Mr.
One
Michael.
Last question.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, your name again was
Joel Michael.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael. I heard Joel, so I just wanted to make sure, Mr. Michael. When you said upper income, what constitutes upper income, and how much was that increase? What percent increase on the tax was that?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, it varies by filing status. It's for a married couple, if I'm remembering this correctly, I believe that the taxable income threshold for tax year 17 is like $261,000. And those for head of household and for single filers, those amounts are lower. The top rate was 7.85, and it was increased for those filers to 9.5. So.
Was it 9.85, Mr. Michael?
9.85, sorry.
2%. Thank you. That's the first time I ever corrected Mr. Michael, ever. Thank you all. Michelle.
It's not working. Okay. Slide number 4 is a quick review of some of the tools that we use in committee for evaluating in a fiscal manner the bills that are proposed before you. We use revenue estimates, which are estimates by the Department of Revenue that provide analysis about how the bill language would change state and local tax collections or state's expenditures for property tax relief programs. This is different than a fiscal note. A fiscal note provides estimates of administrative costs for relevant state agencies prepared under the direction of Minnesota Management and Budget. And most, if you serve in other committees, most other committees use fiscal notes as their mainstay to judge a piece of legislation, whereas this committee, the Tax Committee and the Property Tax and Local Tax Division, we use revenue estimates to gauge what that impact is, so we have a clear idea or an estimate of how tax revenues will be impacted. A third item is local impact notes. These are estimates of local government or school district fiscal impact on proposed legislation. And then finally, we pull all of these together when the committee works on an omnibus bill, and we use legislative budget tracking sheets to provide a compilation of all of these costs, so we have an idea of what the total impact of an omnibus bill. And now, more on about property tax administration. With
welcome, Mr. Klayman.
I'm Chris Klayman with House Research. The next slide provides just a graphical overview of the basic property tax administration system. You can see in each one of those rectangles there's an entity that's responsible for doing one part of the administration system. Up at the top, you see the assessor. The assessor is going to determine the estimated market value for a piece of property. They'll also determine the appropriate classification rate for that property. And the assessor will also send the valuation notice to the taxpayer about what their estimated market value is. That information then flows to the county auditor, who determines the tax capacity or the tax base for each one of those taxing jurisdictions. They will also, the county auditor also determines the rates and will send the truth in taxation notices out to taxpayers as well. The county treasurer's role is to handle the payments and the distribution of tax to the taxing jurisdictions, as well as sending out tax statements. You can see also on the left box, Boards of Appeal and Equalization, that's one of the ways that a taxpayer has to appeal the determination of estimated market value by the assessor. A taxpayer can also make a call to the assessor, see if they can straighten it out that way in some cases, or they can appeal that to the tax court as well.
We got a couple questions, Mr. Klayman, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klayman, as far as the assessor's role, to what extent does the assessor receive direction from our Department of Revenue in determining maybe which classifications get emphasis in particular years? I mean, this is what the people tell me, that they think there's, the shifting that goes around as far as classifications are chosen in various cycles. Is that true, or is this a myth that people just think happens?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I can't speak, directly to the specific, Department of Revenue practices that they have. I mean, somebody from the department could probably speak to that in more detail. In general, if there is an issue that sort of is bubbling up to the surface in the assessment world, somebody may ask the Department of Revenue to take a look at, for instance, how should a property be classified, or are there particular classifications of property that we're seeing issues with, and the department may issue, for instance, some guidance which provides at a state level a determination of how county assessors should handle the assessing of certain types of property. So as for specifics on that process, the department could answer that better than I could.
And we will have the department in later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask them when they appear.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I had is it the same process for both commercial and individual property?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bart, in general, yes. So the assessor... assessors are required under state law to determine an accurate market value for all real property in the state. The timelines are the same in most cases. So the process doesn't really differ. I guess one key difference between the assessment of, say, commercial industrial property and residential property or homestead property is that typically the appraisals that would have to be used to determine the market value for commercial industrial property are quite a bit more complex. And in addition, there is state-assessed property, too. So utility company property is assessed by the state, for instance. So the state, as opposed to the county, would handle the assessment of that property.
Thank you, Mr. Klayman.
Moving on to the next slide here. This just provides this slide concerns the property tax timeline. I think the key point to really focus on when it comes to the property tax timeline is that our property tax cycle really spans two separate calendar years. And the first year is the assessment year. That's when your estimated market value is set. And then the second year is the taxes payable year. And that taxes payable year, that's when you actually pay the tax based on the assessment for the previous calendar year. The tax cycle ends when the final second half property tax payments have been sent and when state aids and credits have been finally dispersed at the end of December. Then moving on to the next slide, truth in taxation. Truth in taxation encompasses a few different things. First is that the taxing jurisdictions have to propose their levies. And then the county auditors, I mentioned this before, will prepare the truth in taxation statements. They have to calculate the tax and provide a determination of what the tax would be based on the proposed levy, and then send those notices out to taxpayers. The notices have to contain information about public meetings. There's a requirement that taxing jurisdictions hold public meetings to determine or to discuss the budget. And then finally, in December, after that process is completed, the final levies are adopted then by the counties. And I think just sort of in general, the idea behind truth in taxation is to provide an opportunity to involve the taxpayer, involve the public in the budgeting process, in addition to trying to encourage taxpayers to relate the estimated market value that the assessors determine on their property to the tax rate and to the budget. So that's truth in taxation. And then I'll turn it over to one of my colleagues here.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a general statement, though. The truth in taxation hearing, though, is too late, really, for the public to weigh in, because all the budgeting determinations are made much earlier. I always tell my people, start paying attention to the county board's decisions in July and then track it. And unfortunately, truth in taxation, at least in the county where I live this past December, was quite interesting because people came opposing the local option sales tax that Watts County adopted, not their property taxes. And so that was really interesting. But that really is too late because I often attend those hearings and, you know, the county announces what their final decision is, but they don't change their minds on that day. They've already made their decision. So I think it's rather misleading. I love the concept, but I just think it should be a little earlier, and probably it can't because of all the decisions they have to make. But that public meeting, I believe, is too late for the public to really weigh in. They need to weigh in when the county board is planning their budget.
And a lot of people have looked at that. I think kind of maybe some shared concern that we could figure out how to make that more interactive. So, Representative Erickson, we're looking forward to your bill. Mr. Kleiman.
Well, that's all I have. I'll turn over the next slide to Mr. Hines, if that's...
Thank you. Mr. Hines, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Now we're going to get into some of the more technical, maybe, aspects of the property tax system. And we'll start with some of the terminology, and I'm just going to go through this real briefly. But just to make sure we're sort of all on the same page and what the terminology means, the first term that's often used, or you'll hear often, is estimated market value. And the idea of estimated market value is that's the value that the assessor concludes or thinks the property is worth. And so it's really a technical term in the system that's sort of a starting point for the conversation is what the assessor has determined the property worth, the estimated market value. In some cases, there's something different. There's a taxable market value, which is different from the estimated market value. For instance, in the case of homesteads, there is a portion of the value that's excluded, the homestead market value exclusion, before you actually compute the tax, and that so that there can be a difference between the estimated market value and the taxable market value. Net tax capacity, then, is the product of the taxable market value times the class rate, and I'm going to get into class rates in a minute, but the multipliers that you use to arrive at the next step in the valuation process, or in the taxation process, really is the net tax capacity. The next slide, the next term is the levy, which I think people use that term quite generally, but the levy is really the amount of money that the local government, that each local taxing jurisdiction has determined that it needs to derive from the property tax system. So the levy is actually a dollar amount that's set by the jurisdiction. In some cases, that levy might be limited by state law. In others, it's completely at the discretion of the local jurisdiction. But that's the levy is just the gross dollar amount that they intend to collect from property taxes. And the tax rate, then, is the dividing the levy by the tax capacity. It's what the county auditor determines the rate that's needed to produce that amount of levy. On each property, you have a net property tax that is the product of this net tax capacity-based levy that I just talked about. There's an additional tax that's called the market value tax that applies directly to the market value of the property that is mostly used for school referendum levies. They don't use the tax capacity system. They're just strictly a multiplier times the market value. Minnesota has a classified property tax system, which means that different types of property pay a different amount of tax versus other states, which may use a system where every $1,000 of market value pays the same tax no matter what type of property it is. In Minnesota's system, it matters what the type of property is. The way that interacts with the system is through the primary mechanism is through the class rate system. So each type of property has a set one or more class rates that apply to it, which is what the market value is multiplied by to get to the tax capacity. So just to go through the most, I'm smiling a little, there are over 50 different classes and class rates, but primarily these slides are going to show you what it is for the most common 8 or 10 classes of property that constitute 95 or 98% of the tax base, I'm sure. So residential homesteads, the most common property we have, have a class rate of 1% on the first $500,000, 1.25% on over $500,000. Agricultural homesteads, and this is so the house on an agricultural homestead is classified the same way as a residential homestead, but the remaining property of the agricultural homestead, so the farmland and buildings, have a class rate of about 0.5 on the. This is up to $2 million of value, just over $2 million, and then 1% over $2 million. So you can see that agricultural homestead land is paying at a rate of approximately half of what a homestead is, 0.5 versus 1%. Agricultural non-homestead property is at 1%, and then commercial, industrial, public utility property is at 1.5% for the first $150,000 of value, but then 2% on over $150,000. So again, these are the most sort of basic ones to bear in mind. So a farm is at 0.5, a home is at 1%, and commercial industrial is at 2%, to give you a rough, which constitutes most of what the differences are.
Mr. Hines, Representative Mark Reddy's question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We're probably going to be talking a lot about agricultural property taxes, and under that 2A, Mr. Hines, that break for the 0.5 for the homestead, I think last year was $2,140,000, which means it's gone down a little bit. And could you explain how that's tied to the inflation and that number actually changes over time?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, yes, I don't remember exactly how long ago we did this, but we started to index the valuation tier 10 to 15 years ago. And so it changes each year by the average growth in farm value per acre in a state in the previous year. And so to show you that it was $600,000 is where it was when we initially started to index it, and it has gone all the way up to $2 million, as you pointed out. But in fact, that the index does not sometimes when we index things, we don't let them go down, only up. In this case, that there's no such floor on that index. So it last year it did reach its highest point at, as you said, $2,140,000. This year it dropped to $2,050,000 because farm values have come down a little. And in fact, for next year, for taxes payable in 18, that is going to be back just below $2 million. So it is now going down, and farm values have come down a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Good question, Representative Marquardt.
Then the next slide just shows a few more of the class rates of classes that aren't quite as big, but they're still large in the overall scheme of things. Apartments are at 1.25%. Residential non-homestead, where it's just a single unit, so basically a single unit property is the same class rates as a homestead, 1 and 1.25. Residential non-homestead, which is a 2 or 3 unit building that's not homesteaded, 1.25%. And seasonal recreational non-commercial, which we often just call cabins, another major classification that we talk about a lot, is still the same rates, 1% and 1.25%. I should maybe add that these rates have been remarkably stable over this system was basically modified in 2001, and by and large, these class rates have stayed in effect ever since then. As you maybe could guess, I've been here a while, and for a long time, the class rates were changing annually almost with legislative attempts to manage the system carefully and closely, and the 2001 reform package, this set of class rates with the 1.5%, 1% and 2% was arrived upon, and has been largely unchanged since then. But prior to that, they were changing all the time.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, looking at seasonal recreational, residential, non-commercial, really the rates are no different from residential homestead, but the state tax weighs in. So how much is generated, if you can recall from memory, by adding that tax to seasonal?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, the seasonal recreational state levy raises about $43 million. It equates to a tax rate of about 20%, which is approximately versus kind of an average tax rate of 100%. So it's kind of a 20% bump on the seasonal rec property. Without wanting to get into too much detail at this point, there's a trade-off. Seasonal recreational property does pay the state levy. However, seasonal rec properties do not pay school referendum
right.
levies. So yeah. In some ways, it's
a lot.
Remarkable how much it evens out in the aggregate. It may not
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, I was a bit surprised when you mentioned that the cap dollar amount for ag homestead is going to be going down for 2018. So does that mean that all the sales for the previous year, 2016, have all been gone through so far, and that number has already been arrived at?
Mr. Hines.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The Department of Revenue has to announce that number prior to so for payable 18 taxes, that's 2017 assessment year, so The assessment date is January 2 of 2017, so theoretically we've already passed the date for pay 18. And so prior to January 2 of 2017, the Department of Revenue has to set that number. So they use the most recent data available. So they would be using pay 2016 compared to pay 2015 data. So that index is really a year or two behind. Yeah. Behind the real world in terms of where that valuation gets set. So I can't even quite do the math to figure out what that peak year really was out in the real world, but it showed up as the tier being the highest for pay 16. We're really a couple years from the highest point now, or a few years down from the highest point.
Thank you. Rep. Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, I just wanted to clarify, just for my edification, so a residential non-homestead one unit, is that an individual apartment, or is that I own a home and I happen to have two homes, or what gets classified as a residential non-homestead one unit?
Mr. Hines.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, that would be a freestanding home, but that's not homesteaded, so that's, you know, generally that probably be one that's rented. Sometimes it's one that's owned by a homeowner because they bought a home and they haven't sold their first home or something. But generally we think of that as rental housing, but single-family housing. A unit in an apartment would not be classified individually. Apartments in general are just given a classification for the entire, or a tax based on the entire building value in that Class 4A apartment.
Thank you.
The next slide then just shows you how this ends up playing out in terms of a tax difference. So for $200,000 of a property that was worth $200,000 of value, what the tax would be based on which of these classifications it came into. So you'll see in this case where an agricultural homestead, that the tax would only be $720, and this is just using some average tax rates. We need to keep in mind that this is a generalization, and any given property's taxes could vary because tax rates are determined by the local jurisdiction. But using general tax rates, the classification system, and a few other features alone, so the ag homestead's tax is as low as $720 for that same $200,000. Commercial industrial is all the way up to $5,000, and a homestead and a cabin are in between those numbers. So just to give a flavor for how that plays out. And in the handout, the longer handout that I believe you received, there's a fuller array of different types of property and what their taxes are under the average tax rates. The next slide is just a brief slide about this homestead market value exclusion that I alluded to earlier. From the estimated market value for homesteads only, there's a subtraction before you compute their tax capacity. And as you can see from this short table here, it's weighted very heavily towards lower valued homes. So it actually reaches its maximum point, the exclusion, at about $30,000 at a homestead value of $75,000. Then the exclusion is actually decreases as the value goes up. And it's just kind of a unique feature to our system. This is why, even though homesteads seem to have the same class rates as residential non-homestead and cabins, this is another reason why homesteads still indeed pay less tax for the same valued home, because they have this exclusion that the other classes don't have. And I'll turn to Mr. Williams for the next slides.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. So the next slide shows you the statewide shares of total market value and property tax, broken down by different categories of property. So as you can see on the market value side, the two largest slices of the pie are residential homestead property at 46.8% and ag property at 23.4%. Commercial industrial property is about 12.1% of the total market value. And you can see that on a relative basis, residential homestead and ag property pay less of the total property tax. So residential homestead properties pay 41.3% of the total tax, and agricultural properties pay 8.5% of the total tax, while commercial industrial property pays 30.3% of the tax, which is larger than its share of total market value. And those discrepancies sort of relate to the different class rates and the market value exclusion that Mr. Hines discussed earlier. I would note that sort of as you make changes in the property tax system as a state, changes in the class rates, changes in exclusions or credits or things like that, that can affect the distribution of tax amongst the different types of properties. And one thing that our office and that Mr. Hines in particular can do is we can model sort of how particular changes in policy at the state level can affect the distribution of tax.
Mr. Williams, we've got a question. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment that in years past we've made these requests, and this committee will continue to receive a number of charts and pie charts throughout the legislative session. Here's a good example of this pie chart. When we get information in our packets that many of us would like to retain, it would be really useful to either have this in color in our packet, or if you don't want to spend the money on that, which I understand, at least under those categories, note the percentage underneath it so we can tie the two together, because looking at this black and white in the little color guides means nothing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hertas, I'd also mention that this information is also available on our website, so we can provide you with a copy of the charts on the website as well for offline usage and when we're out of
community. I appreciate that, but it would be helpful to not have to shuffle through that stuff when you want to look at the stuff.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next slide shows the breakdown of property taxes by different types of government. As you can see, the three largest slices of the pie are county government at 31.3%, school districts at 27.1%, and city government, excluding TIF, at 25.4%. So sort of at a high level, the biggest collector of property taxes in the state are county governments. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to hand it back to Mr. Hines.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, now... the next slide is, we often get asked, how does Minnesota compare to other states? The Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, in combination with a national organization called the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, does a study that I believe they're now doing annually of that looks at property taxes in across the country. And that what they... look at taxes in an urban city or in the biggest city in each state, and then also in a rural city in each state. And they've been doing this for a while, so they've got a procedure that they feel pretty good about. And so just to sort of highlight what they found in the most recent ranking, which is based, I believe, on 2012 taxes. No, excuse me, I think it's 2015. The rankings for homesteads in both urban and rural cities, and they've measured two different values, 150,000 and 300,000. We rank 21st, 22nd there, so we're kind of middle of the pack on our homestead taxes. On a commercial property worth $1 million, they have us ranked at seventh in the urban one and at second in a rural one. So we rank high in commercial. In industrial, they have us ranked at 19th in the urban one and 7th in rural. And an apartment building, kind of like homesteads, kind of in the middle of the pack. So it's an interesting exercise that they do. The industrial property is especially kind of hard to make an equal comparison. A lot of states tax their personal property, and Minnesota doesn't, and kind of can depend on the assumptions you make about how much is of the value is commercial or is real property versus personal property. But using one of the two examples they use, this is the numbers you get. So the rural, especially commercial industrial, tends to rank fairly high, especially. The next slide.
Mr. Hines, Representative Barr has a question for you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hines. One question I had is, how do they make the determination for the commercial versus industrial comparison? When we talked about, or when you talked about the rates, it looks like we blend commercial and industrial into one category. Do we also separate those out for comparative purposes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, that's a good question that you raised. We in Minnesota, we treat commercial and industrial the same. So assessors classify something as either commercial or industrial, but it doesn't matter what they which class the assessor puts it, they're going to be classed the same. So within a given city, for instance, a commercial property and an industrial city property that are the same value are going to have the same tax. It's just that when you do these national comparisons, some states may or may not tax their commercial and industrial differently, so that could be a difference. Another, the biggest reason really is has to do with this difference between personal and real property. So they'll start the people who do the study will take $1 million industrial property and assume that, say, 60% of it is personal property and 40% is real. And so they'll really compute Minnesota's tax based on 40% of $1 million, whereas another state that taxes personal will be based on a full 100%. So that's how you get differences in commercial industrial. But in Minnesota, we treat them exactly the same.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I'd ask a favor of the committee, the research folks. The ag taxes are a big topic in greater Minnesota. And we're hearing more and more comparing our taxes to Iowa, that prime land in Iowa is $15, $20 an acre. You cross the border to our state and it's $70, $80, $90 an acre. Could we get a brief comparison of how Iowa taxes their ag land and how else they raise revenue? I have to tell people you have to raise revenue somehow, but what is Iowa doing to keep their ag land taxes as low as they apparently are?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we can certainly look into that, but right off the top of my head, I certainly don't know. And ag taxes, as we have looked into this over the years, are complicated to try to compare because there's a lot of different devices states have that deviate from market value and different kinds of credits, different really in the valuation process itself can be different. So we can attempt to take a look at that. But I should note that the study I've just been referencing on the rankings does not attempt to get at ag property. I think probably partly for some of those reasons that it's just very hard to harder to compare than other types, really.
Representative Frankie has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, for clarification, can you tell me, I think I know, but this is best to worst or worst to best?
Mr. Hines. Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. A national ranking of first would be highest. So I think you want bigger numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Hines.
Representative, they tax everything in this state and very high. Representative Protoss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, you mentioned with regard to the rankings that this was 2015 taxes. Did you mean 2015 taxes payable 16?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's payable 15.
Okay.
I'm just going to look in the longer document and see if I footnoted that better. Payable 15.
Okay, so this is 2 years old then.
Right. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, moving on now to the next slide. This is just looking a little bit more in depth at school district levies. School district levies, which are not the direct jurisdiction of this committee, but ultimately the K-12 bill does come through the tax committee, so there is some opportunity for sort of oversight of what they're doing. School district levies are a big part of the picture, and there's some kind of interesting features of their system that are a little different from the taxes on counties and cities that we mostly focus on. So the features, I guess, to take away from are the black background pieces of the pie here represent the parts of the school district levy that are approved by voters. And so roughly, I think it's about 47% of the school levy for pay 16 is actually approved by voters as opposed to the other 53%, which is approved by the school boards. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that almost half the school levy is approved, is the voter approved. And then secondly, the cross-hatched portions of this pie chart are attempting to show the portion of the tax that's based on the market value tax rather than the net tax capacity. So again, the difference is that the market value tax, which is this operating referendums and some other parts of the referendum that are not voter approved anymore, but all with to do with operating, none with capital, are based on market value, so that their commercial industrial pays the same rate as homes in that market value tax. That's one of the big differences, and the other one is that ag property does not pay the referendum market value tax. Moving on now to the state general tax, the state does collect about 10% of the overall tax burden the overall property tax burden is the state levy, which applies only to commercial industrial property and seasonal recreational property. And the amount is $863 million for calendar year 2017. It is increases by a rate of inflation from year to year, and this tax has been in place since that same 2001 reform that I talked about earlier. So I'll leave it at that. I guess 95% of the tax is applied to commercial industrial and the other 5% on seasonal recreational shares. The next slide then is the...
I got that one. Slides
Ms. Schill?
19 and 20 reflect major property tax relief programs. And this is a quick summary of those programs, including who benefits and how much spending is forecasted in fiscal 2018. And I'll take these two together. This is important. I mean, you can take a look at local government aid. The amount is $519 million. County program aid, $209. Kind of new to this list, you'll take a look at the operating capital aid has bumped up to $122, and the local option revenue aid from a couple of bienniums back is now at $54 million. Slide 20 includes also the debt service equalization aid, but the property tax refunds. The homestead credit state refund is at $435 million, and the property tax refund for renters, the renter's credit, is at $230 million. Now, if you take the top four of all these, LGA, CPA, and the two PTRs, that comprises $1.1 billion, or about 82% of the $1.36 billion fiscal 2018 budget for overall tax aids and credits. And next is Ms. Dalton, who is going to give you more detail on each of these aid programs.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Welcome back again, Ms. Dalton. In a different chair.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. And I actually think, given we've just done another shift of staff, to point something out to new members of this committee, within your packet, there is a one-sheet thing that actually lists all of this nonpartisan staff that works here and what we do. You do not have to be tested on this. You don't have to memorize who does what. This can help you. And if you ever need anything and you aren't sure who to go to, just call any of us, and we will get you to the right person.
So. And new members especially, as you look at this, thank you, Ms. Dalton. These are the folks that end up writing your bills in the end anyway, so get to know them and where they hang out and what their phone number is. And if you call the wrong one, they'll get you the right one. I found that out. I don't have mine from last year, Ms. Dalton, so thank you. Now I'm going to actually put it in a place I can recall it. So thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to start with the largest general purpose aid, property tax aid that is paid to the state, and that is the city LGA program. and it's one that this committee revisits often. So you will see me. This is also one of the tax aids that we can actually model. So if there are changes in the distribution formula for it, we will actually do a run that will show which cities win and lose or gain if we put more money into the appropriation. So that's, again, just one of our modeling capabilities. So this slide basically talks shows you how LGA has changed over time. The high watermark for LGA, I believe, that was actually paid was, I believe, $534 million back in the early 2000s. One of the things I want to point out is that for 2008 through 2010, those are the amounts that were paid. Cities were actually told that they were going to get more money, but because there was a budget crisis, their aids were cut after they were originally certified. And so these were the amounts actually paid. And as you can see, the amount that's been distributed under City LGA in from 2015 through what has been certified to be paid in 2017 is a frozen amount. The City LGA formula underwent a major reform in 2013. This reform was actually worked out with representatives of all the city groups. One of the things that, as you work with us, you'll find out that the City LGA formula is one that changes has changed often. Right now, we seem to be on a schedule of major reforms about every 10 years. So I'm hoping I will not be around here for the 2023 reform. The formula that was adopted in 2013 basically calculates aid increases based on the size of a gap between how we measure a city's unmet need and its current aid. A city can only, unlike the formula that was in place from 2003 to 2013, a city can only lose aid if its current amount is greater than what the formula says it needs. During that 2003 to 2013 period, a city's aid was determined not only what based on its own need, but based on the need of other cities. So it was kind of a volatile system, and people weren't real happy about the volatility that existed in the program during that period. So now, once you get the aid, it's yours as long as the formula says you still need it. What is unmet need? Unmet need is a is based on a number of factors that measure need, which I'll talk about in the next slide, minus your ability to pay. And ability to pay is measured as the average city tax rate times each city's individual tax base. So how do we measure city need? We actually have a different way of measuring city need depending on a city size. We have 853 cities in this state. Only 200 of them have a population greater than 25,000. So 600 and some cities actually have a population under 2,500. I believe our smallest city has a population of 17. So we go from population of 17 to Minneapolis, which has a population of close to 400,000. So it's hard to measure need for cities that vary in size a lot. And so for cities under 2,500, basically there is a – the only factor that goes into figuring out how much need they have is their city size. And the maximum need a city under 2,500 can have is $640 per capita. The need measure for cities, kind of the medium-sized cities, 2,500 to 10,000, it's based on – percent of housing built before 1940, average household size, population decline from peak census estimate. Each of these are kind of a proxy for some factor that influences city spending. For instance, One factor that influences city spending is your age of your infrastructure. Nobody measures age of city infrastructure on any type of consistent basis. So percent of housing built before 1940 is used as a proxy for indicating how old your infrastructure is. Population decline from peak census estimate, one of the factors that is, you know, that indicates is, you know, once you build infrastructure, you build it for your largest population. If your population is declining, you generally don't abandon infrastructure. City of Detroit has now abandoned infrastructure, and over time, you probably do abandon infrastructure, but in the short term, you don't. And so that's why that factor's in there. This is a factor that has really had a major impact on distributing aid to rural cities, because there's a number of declining smaller cities in greater Minnesota. And then the factors for large cities, cities with population greater than 10,000, is again housing built before 1940, housing built between 1940 and 1970, jobs per capita, which is a measure of how many people kind of commute into your city every day, and population density. The reason housing built between 1940 and 1970 is in here is this actually deals with a lot of the older suburbs that were developed post-World War II, but now actually do have some aging infrastructure concerns. As I said, ability to pay is based on city's tax base and the average city tax rate. There is no maximum increase for any city on how much aid they can go up in any given year, but there is a floor on how much a city can lose. And as you recall, a city can only lose if they're getting more than the formula says they need, and the maximum they can lose in any year is the lesser of 10 times the city population or 5% of the city's levy in the previous year. We have a new town LGA program. Originally, when LGA was enacted back in 1972, all local governments except school districts got local government aid. Over time, it became primarily a city program, and town LGA was actually eliminated in 1992. A new program was reenacted in 2013. It only spends $10 million as opposed to the $519 million going out to city aid. So it's a relatively small program. It's based on a number of factors, the amount of property in the township that is agricultural property, the total size of the township, and the town population. If you want to see the actual distribution of where that money is going geographically, if you go to trying to see what page it is, page 24 of the more detailed handout, there is actually a map that will show you kind of where the townships are located that tend to benefit from this program. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Hines, who does county programming.
Thanks, Ms. Dalton. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, county program aid is the county's kind of rough equivalent to local government aid. It's a general purpose aid that they're allowed to use for any purpose and generally regarded as a tool that the legislature uses to help reduce county levies. That being said, it's of a much smaller magnitude than local government aid, which is Ms. Dalton summarizing was about over 500 million. County program aid is only 210 million or 209 million. As you can see on the slide, it's been the same amount basically for the last 4 years. And prior to that, it did jump from the $160 million or so level from 2010 through 2013 up to $209 million, and it stayed stable since then. And the current law provides that it would be that same amount on into the future, absent legislative change. County program aid also is distributed by a formula like LGA, but it's a much simpler formula. Basically, one half of the money is distributed under something called a need formula, and the other was called tax base equalization. The need formula just looks at a few general factors that are thought to contribute to county needs for spending, such as the population and particularly the population of senior citizens is counted more heavily. Also, number of people in various social service programs and things such as that. Then the tax-based equalization formula looks simply at the size of the city's the county's population and its tax base. The next slide shows that, so the need aid is based on the, the county age index, the number of Part 1 crimes in the county, and the number of households receiving food stamps. Tax-based equalization aid is the tax base in the population. This formula has been in place since 2003, and that's when the whole program was first created, really, and it has not changed since its initial it has been tweaked slightly in that time frame, but it's been largely unchanged since that time. The next program to mention is the Agricultural Market Value Credit, and this is a credit program that is the last of the major credit programs. We used to have more. A credit program is a program where the state provides some kind of relief directly to some type of property that's taken off their tax statement, and then the state instead makes those payments to the taxing jurisdictions. And the main one left is the one for agricultural homesteads, and it's kind of a simple formula. It basically reaches a maximum of $490 at approximately $260,000 of market value, and then from any whatever the value of your farm is, if it's over $260,000, whatever it is, you get $490 of this agricultural market value credit, and that costs approximately $39 million a year. We increased that amount. I think we approximately doubled it 3-4 years ago. And I think Ms. Manzi will take it to the next slides.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Welcome, Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi in the Research Department. I work on the Homestead Credit Refund and Property Tax Refund for renters. These programs are different from the aid programs that Mr. Hines and Ms. Dalton have discussed, in that the aid under these programs is paid directly to individuals, so it's paid directly to homeowners or renters, whereas the other aid programs are paid to other units of government. Both the Homestead Credit Refund and the Property Tax Refund for renters provide relief to people whose property taxes are high relative to their income. There's a schedule in statute for each program, and if your property taxes exceed a threshold percentage of your income, then the refund will equal a percentage of the excess over that threshold up to a maximum amount. People claim these refunds by filing Form M1PR with the Department of Revenue. Those are usually filed it could be filed any time after you get your property tax statement in March for homeowners, and after you receive a certificate of rent paid from your landlord for renters, which is due in January. The refunds are paid to renters beginning in August of the year and to homeowners beginning in September. The next slide shows you the dollar amount paid in refunds. These are actual figures for refunds filed in 2015. So there was $582 million paid in 2015 refunds. Over half of it went to homeowners. Over 400,000 homeowners received homestead credit state refunds. And over 300,000 renters received refunds. So it's going out to a lot of people. And the average is over $800 for homeowners and over $600 for renters. The program limits for this year coming up for refunds to be filed in 2017, which for homeowners will be based on their payable 2017 taxes. If your income is under $108,659, you may be eligible for a refund. If your property taxes are high relative to your income, the maximum refund you could claim is $2,660. For renters, the property tax is assumed to equal 17% of the rent that you paid. The maximum household income is just under $60,000, and the maximum refund you could be eligible for is just over $2,000. Both the income parameters and the maximum amounts are indexed each year for inflation. Let's see, and before I think the next, okay, before I go on to the special property tax refund, on those, the two property tax refunds, we don't have the capacity to model proposals for those in-house research, but Ms. Schill and I do have a collection of past proposals and past estimates from the Department of Revenue, so we can help you to develop new proposals and in some cases get you a ballpark of it and then work with the Department of Revenue to get a more precise estimate of what the change will be in the program under whatever it is you propose, whether you want to make it more generous relative to what people pay in taxes or you want to restrict it.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, what did you say was indexed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the income levels and the maximum refund. So if you were to look in the statute, there would be a table that showed probably about 20 different income ranges for homeowners. And for each income range, there would be a threshold percentage, a copayment percentage, and a maximum refund amount. The threshold percentage is the percentage of income that your taxes would have to exceed for you to be eligible for a refund. And that threshold percentage gets higher in the table as your income increases. So there's a higher bar to get over to be eligible for a refund the higher your income is.
And then so that's page 30 of the larger handout. Yeah, I see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi.
Very well spelled out. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. With the indexing to inflation, is that CPI or the implicit price deflator?
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Representative Joaquin, it's indexed based on the Consumer Price Index.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Manzi.
Moving on, there's also a sub-refund of the property tax refund called the Special Property Tax Refund, or it's commonly referred to as targeting. This refund is not based on your income, so anyone can claim the targeting refund regardless of what your income level is. It's a refund for homeowners, and it provides relief to homeowners who have a large property tax increase from 1 year to the next. So in order to claim the targeting refund, your taxes must have gone up by more than 12% from the previous year. And then you receive a refund that is equal to, what? Help me, Mr. Hines. 60%? 60% of the amount over the 12% increase. And there is no maximum refund on the targeting refund, I don't believe. All things we might have put on the slide, but we did put in the larger packet. So now I am looking there. 1,000. At one time there was not, Representative Erickson, and there were some people who received very large refunds, and when the committee became aware of that and so on, there was a maximum put in place. And there's no income, there's no indexing of that maximum amount. The program is it's at a rather low level historically right now. The total amount claimed in 2015 was $3.9 million, which I think is one of the lowest levels in the last 10 or 20 years, and very few returns, a smaller average refund. It's how much is paid out in the targeting refund is really a function of how volatile homestead property taxes are. I think that the November forecast projects that this program is going to get larger than what it was in 2015 in the coming years. Another thing I want to mention about these programs, both the targeting refund and the other two property tax refund programs, the homestead credit refund and the refund for renters, is that there is not a fixed appropriation for these programs. There's an open appropriation. So homeowners and renters figure what their refunds are based on the schedule that's in statute, and they claim them, and the state will pay them, and there's an open appropriation. So unlike LGA or county program aid, where there's a specific amount that is set for to be paid in those aids each year, these refunds and the targeting refund, it simply is whatever people are eligible for is what is paid.
So, Ms. Manzi, what does that mean for the forecast, the budget forecast around that those parameters?
Mr. Chair, what happens is the Department of Revenue works with Minnesota Management and Budget to project how much will be paid out in these programs, and they both, I think all the homeowner refund and the renter refund are, and the targeting refund, I think all three of them are separate lines in the general fund statement that comes out as part of the forecast each November and in February. So you can see in there what they're projecting as far as the dollar amount for each year within the forecast window.
Thank you. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, Kathy Schill. House Fiscal, just to follow up on that discussion, you each should have a spreadsheet in your packet. Is that correct? Maybe not. I know that we had, we'll make sure you have it, but you can see on the first three lines of the spreadsheet, and we'll make that available to you later, you can track the property tax refunds. And just to answer the question with respect to the forecast on the targeting PTR for fiscal 18, there's a blip, an uptick of almost 6.7 million for fiscal 18, and then it flatlines at about 5 million for each year in the forecast window after that. So we'll keep a track, an eye on that for you. The next slide, actually slides 34 and 35, talk about the property tax burden. This shows Minnesota taxpayer property tax burdens for tax year 2015 by population quintile. First for effective tax rates on slide 34, and then its distribution. The numbers for gross property taxes were derived by adding together the numbers for the residential local property taxes, non-residential local property taxes, and the state property tax. In 2012, homeowner property taxes after PTR accounted for 21% of the total state and local tax burden on Minnesota residents. As property taxes in general, these rates are regressive even after the PTR is applied, going from 5.3%, which is the first quintile bar, for the lowest income filers, to 2.7% for the highest income filers. And I might add that we're using tax year 2012 right now. There is going to be an update to the tax incidence study, which is done by the Department of Revenue. That's done at the end of done and presented to the committee at the end of February, the beginning of March. So we're looking for an update to those numbers. And once again, remember, as Mr. Hines said earlier in this testimony, that property tax information is on that two-year time delay. And so even though we'll have an update to the taxes incidence study, it will be reflective of 2016 that uses taxes from 2014. So just keep in mind that a number of these reports reflect that time lag.
Ms. Schill, Representative Loeffler has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Schill, is this table of property tax burden, is this just homeowners, or does this include renters as well?
Ms. Schill.
I'll let Mr. Hines respond to
Mr.
that.
Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, this does include renters as well. And as Ms. Schill alluded, or you may not have realized, this includes not only the direct property taxes paid, but also the taxes that are paid by businesses that are according to the incident study mechanics of how they do that study fall on Minnesota residents. All property taxes are figured into this these quintiles here.
Representative Loeffler.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if there's any way for us to pull out renters versus homeowners, that would be really interesting given the really rapidly changing rental market that we're experiencing right now.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lothar, that information is available within the tax incidence study tables. It was work to put them together, so it's almost easier to look at them separately, yes.
Thank you. Ms. Schill.
And this is slide 35. Once again, this shows who pays property taxes by the quintiles. So once again, the fifth quintile is the group that is 50%, over 50% payers, whereas the first quintile is 4.7%.
Moving on to the next slide, just briefly touch on mining taxes. Mines and facilities used in the production of taconite are exempt from the property tax, so they don't pay the property tax in the counties where they're located. Instead of a property tax, the mines pay a production tax on taconite. The production tax on taconite, well, there was $111 million of production tax paid in 2015. Similar to the property tax cycle, the mining tax cycle, as it were, also, you could look at it as spanning two calendar years as well. There's the production year, and then there's the year of distributions, or the distribution year. So for distributions in 2015, there was $111 million. The tax rate on taconite is indexed to inflation. For 2015, that rate was $2.597 per ton. And the tax base is an average of 3 years of production, and that's to smooth out some of the gyrations in the mining business that can cause fluctuations that can be significant from 1 year to the next. And I guess the last key point here is that the distributions from the production tax are all distributed to the taconite assistance area on the Iron Range. So you know, all of that production tax revenue stays in those communities where the mines and the facilities are, where there are impacts to the mines and facilities.
Mr. Klingon, quick question. So does the in lieu of property tax, does that apply only to the mining equipment and buildings, or is it all of the leased land as well?
Mr. Chair, that would include the real property. The mines, yeah. So the real property and in other words, there wouldn't be an assessment for the mines or the property. That would just be subject to the production tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take you through the very next slide. It's very short.
Thank you.
We are actually talking about a program that is currently not in effect. Levy limits, as Mr. Hines mentioned earlier, occasionally there are some limits to how much local governments can raise in property taxes. There are some existing ones that apply to things like how much debt levy they can have and things like that. But in the past, there's also been general levy limits that have applied to counties and to larger cities. This was originally enacted in 1972, and this is something that has gone on and off over the years. If you actually go to page 40 of the larger document, there is a table that basically tells you which years we've had levy limits and which years we have not had levy limits. The last year it was imposed was 2014. The statute stays in the books because we don't want to rewrite them every time they get reimposed. But basically what you should know about them is generally they look at levy plus the aids, the general purpose aids that the county or city gets, allows some growth, often based on population growth or changes in tax capacity, and then they often allow growth in what are called the special levies, levies that are not subject to those limits, which often are related to debt or disaster or other very unique circumstances that can affect the local government. As I said, they are not in here. They are not imposed right now. But they are one of the things that factor into the property tax modeling we do. One of the things that our office does along with Senate Council and Research and the Department of Revenue is we will do projections for what we think is going to happen to property taxes, not in pay 17, but in pay 18, based on current law and then also any changes that are proposed. We will talk more in detail about how we make those projections when we give you a baseline pay 2018 property tax run, which will happen a little later in the session. One other thing, this is not related to property taxes. One other program that this division has jurisdiction over is local sales taxes. And it happens to be one of the areas I also cover. Generally, there's a statutory prohibition against local sales taxes and income taxes. It was enacted in 1971 as part of the Minnesota Miracle when the state decided to start paying large general-purpose aid programs to the local governments. They enacted this prohibition as part of that. This means that most local sales taxes have been enacted, and if you have a jurisdiction that wants a local sales tax, they need to come before the legislature and get a special law authorizing them to impose one. In the past, there haven't been very many. There was a kind of an explosion of these in the last 5 years. There are currently 27 of them currently imposed, and again, the larger packet actually lists all of them that are currently in enacted and are being imposed and when they were enacted. One of the other issues that has happened, and this actually occurred in the Transportation Committee as opposed to in the Tax Committee, is that the Transportation Committee essentially established some local county transportation local sales taxes.
Lost. Sorry, Mr. Chair, but the acronym is LOST.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, you are right. It LOST for local option sales taxes. So
I can't think of anything to add to that.
One of these is the Metropolitan Transportation Tax. It's run by it. There are five counties imposing that. That's often referred to as CTIB. Don't ask me what CTIB, the acronym means. I don't know. I can never remember. What?
County Transit Investment Board.
Okay. And as I said, that encompasses five counties in the metro area, and they impose a local sales tax of 0.25%. And there are currently 26 other counties that impose under the other optional transportation sales tax that allows counties to impose it for either transportation or transit purposes. What's unique about these is they do not require voter approval, unlike the general ones that are mainly imposed by the cities. Finally, there are lodging taxes. Some of them are imposed by special law, similar to the general local sales taxes, and those are rates of 1 to 5 or 6%, I think, the highest one is. But there is actually in statute a general authority for lodging taxes up to 3% that may be used for tourism purposes. I believe there's a roughly 200 cities, townships, counties, or joint powers that impose those local lodging taxes under the statutory authority.
Ms. Dalton, could you quickly, the local option sales tax, who passes it first? We pass it, and then the local government passes it? I know it's gone, it's flipped back and forth, and I'm still confused.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is actually a statute, 297A.99, that outlines the process for local governments to come in and ask for a local sales tax. As part of that process, the statute says before a local government comes in, they should hold a referendum at a general election outlining the tax and what they want to use it for and how long it will be used before they come in and then ask the legislature to grant them the authority. Having said that, because many, for most cities, there's not a general election except every other year, often they will come in and they will have in their special legislation, notwithstanding language, notwithstanding this, the legislature will approve it, provided that they get voter approval at the next general election. So although the statute requires them to hold the election first, in reality, it's being done both ways.
Thank you. Election, local election first, I got
it. Mr. Chair, that's not... thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not to be... the local sales tax is not the same as the lost, though, because the lost was enacted in 2013, and that's without voter approval. That's why it's raised the ire of... Mr. Rubis is shaking his hand. No. Knox County just adopted the lost for transportation.
Wasn't it called the land of the lost?
Local option sales tax. Isn't that correct, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, lost actually refers to all local sales taxes because they're all optional. But when I think in the transportation area, when they are referring to lost, they are referring to the county transportation taxes that are authorized under chapter under section 297A.993. And you're right, those ones do not require election. All it requires is approval by the county board.
Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the last 2 minutes, I will cover tax increment financing. If I can quickly run through these 10 slides. I'm going to go through what is tax increment, how it works mechanically, what are the types of districts, because the rules vary by the type of district, what's the but-for test, what can the revenues be used for. Pat tells me we end at 10.
We do? We do, Mr. Michael, and that's more than 2 minutes from now.
I won't slow it. I'll slow down a little bit.
We do want to do introductions, Mr. Michael.
Right. Yes,
so
and I'll,
2 minutes
right.
Sounds very good. And as right. As Mr. Rubis said, we're going to spend the last 2 minutes going through the most complicated part.
Right. So tax increment financing is an important part of the property tax. It's about $250 million a year, so it's not a trivial amount. You've been talking about some of these aid programs that cost $10 million and that sort of thing. TIF is generally controlled by cities. And what it is, it's a method of essentially when there's a new development that pays additional property tax, tax increment captures that, allows cities to capture that incremental property tax to use it as a financing tool. In Minnesota, TIF is used by cities generally for two purposes. One, to help the development, to induce the development to happen. That's the classic use of tax increment. But cities also effectively use it as a way to pay for public improvements that may not necessarily be directly related to inducing that specific development. So mechanically, how does TIF work? Basically, like I said, it captures the growth in tax base, and that's done by certifying the value of the district when it's created. So you certify the tax capacity of a geographic area. Then the growth in that certified amount is called the original tax capacity. And in Minnesota, and this is unique compared to most other states as far as I'm aware, we also certify the tax rate at that time. So if the cities and counties increase their levy and that drives up the rate of tax, that doesn't generate more increment, but that's set aside separately and goes to their general funds. So Minnesota, you certify both the value and the rate, and when you, as the value grows over time, that amount is called captured value. And then you calculate increment by simply multiplying that original tax rate times the captured tax capacity. And that's the revenue that tax increment generates that can be used then to finance either helping the development or paying for public infrastructure. And you also recognize that if there's inflation, not just, you know, okay, you build a building, but these districts last for up to 25 years, and some of that over time will just be growth due to inflation. That gets captured too. So what are the types of tax increment districts? There are basically six main types. Economic development, they have an 8-year limit, so they can capture only 8 years of increment. This is generally used for manufacturing, research and development facilities, and in some counties in greater Minnesota, it can also be used for tourism. It also is used for warehousing. Housing, this has to be for affordable housing, so there are income and rent limits that are imposed on this for rental properties, and income and value limits on homeowner properties. Those districts have up to 25 years. Redevelopment and renewal and renovation districts, these are the classic uses of tax increment where you've got what in the industry is referred to as blight or dilapidated buildings that you essentially want to renew or replace. Soils condition districts are districts where there's pollution that needs to be cleaned up. Hazardous substance districts are a unique animal that they're created within another district that has some kind of pollution or contamination, and you actually, with that original value, you're allowed to reduce the original value down to zero and then use the taxes from that value to pay for pollution cleanup. There are only a very handful of districts that use it. The but-for test has always been considered to be a key part of tax increment. As the name suggests, it's basically a way of saying we don't want to provide government incentives to induce development if it's going to happen anyway. So it has to the development has to have only happened because, but for we gave the development tax increment financing. So how is this put in operation? Basically, it's a city finding. So it's what we're talking about is the opinion of the city. And it applies when you approve the original TIF plan and create the district. It doesn't apply if a decision is made 2 or 3 years later and you decide to change the TIF plan and spend more money. So it's only at the original point of creating. And as I said, it's based on the opinion. And you really have to make two findings. One is that this development wouldn't happen if we didn't provide TIF to it. And secondly, there's a requirement that most properties, some development would happen even if you didn't do it. And so if the city thinks there would be some other development that would happen, you have to find that the development that you're inducing will increase the market value over what would have happened otherwise. But again, all of this is based on the city's opinion, and it's pretty hard to challenge it.
Mr. Michael, Representative Ewa, TMS question.
Thank you, Chair. Going back to the other slide, can you give an example between the difference between regular pollution in soils and a hazardous substance? With a hazardous substance, would they have to be classified Superfund site, or are you talking the difference between volatile organic compounds and somebody just having a petroleum tank that leaks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joaquin, no, there's no difference. The difference is in the mechanics of with the hazardous substance. That's an instance where you create a sub-district within an existing TIF district and write the original value down below what it was at the certified time. But the type of pollution is not necessarily any difference. So what are TIF revenues used for? Site acquisition and preparation. This is a classic thing. You buy the land, you remove existing buildings, you clean up pollution, or you can put in public improvements, like you may have to put in sewer and water service to the area, or you may need to improve the streets. You can also then, after you buy the land with it, you can turn the land over to the developer to less than what the city paid for it or paid to improve it. So that's typically in the business referred to as a land write down. Sometimes you can pay for private improvements. This is typically not what's paid. You don't pay for building a store or a warehouse or something like that. But in the case of housing, the law does allow you to actually pay for the housing. So what can't you use TIF for? Anything that's not explicitly permitted in the law. In general, cities are not allowed to use it to pay for city hall or for a fire hall or something like that, because the taxes are the taxes that are imposed by all taxing districts, even though the city controls increments. So if they were allowed to do this, they could essentially finance city buildings with county and school taxes. And as I said, most private buildings, you can't do it. So how much of our tax base is in tax increment? This graph shows 1979 was when the general TIF law that we used was passed. And so you can see how it ramped up. In the late 80s and early 90s, the legislature became concerned about the extent to which cities were using tax increment when it reached almost 9% on average of city tax bases. This graph shows for cities that that have tax increment. So the legislature began to put major restrictions on it in 88 through 90, and then in the 2001 property tax reform, a big chunk of the tax that previously was captured was eliminated, and that's where the major drop was that you can see up in at 2002 when it reached its peak. These bars show tax increment revenues, and again you see the ramping up and how they've been fairly stable in the last 15 years or so since the 2002 change where there's a drop there. This graph simply shows the number of districts by type, and if you want more detail, all of you, the Office of the State Auditor will send every committee member this. The new one of this graph is based on this report. A new one of these will be sent to you in February, I believe. So, and that it has more information about these kinds of things. So what?
That's required reading for the committee, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, that's up to you if you want to require it.
Thank you.
There are various limits on this. I won't get into. The committee typically has one or two hearings where you hear tax increment bills, and usually they're asking for specific districts to be exempted from some of these rules. There are year rules so that, you know, you've got 4 years that development has to happen or parcels drop out. There are limits on pooling. That's the extent to which you can take increment from one TIF district and use it in another area outside that district. There's a five-year time limit on how long you have to spend increments, and cities often for individual districts ask for exemptions from these state law rules. And there's more information on our website if you really want to get into this stuff. The TIF primer that's listed there is about a 50-page resource on all of these various myriad complex rules. So with that, I'll stop it. Sorry.
Mr. Michael, you're good. Thank you, sir. Just quickly, not having been part of a city council that's done this before, explain to us exactly kind of practically how it works. So the city is going to borrow money to do this development, and then so I understand how things calculated with the increment times the tax rate. So we got that. Then explain to us kind of practically how it works for a city, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, in the classic use of tax increment, the way you described it would work, the city would say, look, we want to redevelop this area. And so what we're going to do is we're going to draw a boundary, a TIF district around that area. We will, in order to finance the acquisition of that land and perhaps tearing down dilapidated buildings, we'll issue city bonds to raise the money to pay for that. And then as it develops and the new building starts to pay higher property taxes, we'll take that those extra property taxes and use it to pay off the bonds that we issued to buy the land and tear down the dilapidated building. That was the classic tax increment. That's the way it was done in the 70s and the 80s. And what happened, of course, is sometimes the cities were not great real estate developers, and sometimes what happened, you know, classically in Minneapolis and St. Paul and elsewhere is that St. Paul had a big hole in its downtown for a long time because they couldn't find somebody to actually do the development because nobody wanted to put up a building there. And so then the city was stuck, and those classically in the early days were general obligation bonds, and so then the city had to levy taxes to pay that. What's happened is starting in the late 80s and 90s, the cities realized, hey, this is too risky. We're not doing this. And so now what more commonly is done are what are called pay-as-you-go districts. And so what happens is that a developer wants to redevelop or develop a site, and they think, hey, this really won't work unless the city gives us some relief on our taxes. And so they will come to the city and say, look, give us tax increment for this parcel. The city will then draw a tax increment district, certify it, and instead of the city actually borrowing money and paying for any of those costs, the developer will go ahead and pay the cost. And that's why. And then as the property tax increments come in, they'll reimburse the developer as the developer provides documentation to the city that under the tax increment agreement, they've incurred costs that are qualified under the development agreement, under the tax increment plan, and under state tax increment law. And so there's really not, now it's not as common that cities actually borrow money on their own where they're at risk with it. Because there were a few examples, more than a few examples, in the 70s and the 80s where cities got burned on that. And so, you know, once burned, twice, you know, you don't put your hand back on the hot stove, and they sort of figured out this. But they still have the authority to issue debt. In some cases, they do that. And you'll find in rural areas, we had one instance that came to the legislature where they did this, and they didn't follow the tax increment rules, and so the state auditor told them to decertify. And they did, and now they're paying the debt, and they don't have a tax increment district.
Well, thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question. Is it too simplistic to look at the original tax on the property still usually going into the general fund, and the captured tax is either doing the pay-as-you-go or going towards the bonds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, that's sort of the general rule of thumb, unless you have this unusual circumstance with a hazardous substance sub-district where you can actually write down the original value. And, of course, what typically would happen, like the slide said, the sites typically appreciate in value even if they're not developed, and that appreciation is captured.
Thank you. Members, we're about to adjourn. We're coming to 10 o'clock here. I think we'll do introductions next week, if that's okay with folks. In your packets, or maybe hand it out, I don't know how it got to you, but there's a sheet here that outlines kind of some guidelines that we used last time. They seem to work real well. We don't have any rules in this committee. So, have at her in this committee, whatever you want to bring. But we've got some guidelines here that are helpful to you, and so take those, and good bedtime pillow reading for you. With that, thank you, members. Thank you to Mr. Michael and the rest of the House Research and Fiscal staff that were here giving us a great presentation. Let's recognize them for their work today. Thank you, guys. With that, members, meetings.